What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. If you are new here, Polititeen is a podcast that hopes to spark political conversation in our youth by talking about current politics with people that are currently politically active. With that being said, thank you for tuning in to today's episode, and as always, happy listening. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. As always, I'm joined by Varun.
Hey, guys. Again, my name is Varun. I am the co-host of the Polititeen podcast, where we try to spark conversation along political lines each and every day. We host podcasts on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so make sure to join us this Friday for another podcast. Now, that said, we're going to have today a special guest named Dr. Mason. Dr. Ronald Mason is a civil rights activist and leader in the community of civil rights. He's the president of UDC, a historically black college in our nation's capital. So we're super, super excited to have Dr. Mason on. He's going to be an amazing guest for us today. And we're excited to ask him a bunch of questions about racial tension in America and the kind of discrimination that's been going on in the past decades and centuries. Damien, how do you feel about having Dr. Mason on?
I think that he's maybe going to be one of our most insightful guests. He has a wide amount of knowledge. He's very accomplished. I'm very excited for it. I think that he's going to give us some amazing insight onto different issues. And you know, he has his perspectives and his solutions to some of America's issues. And it's going to be very interesting to listen to those from the man himself, as opposed to just reading them online.
Absolutely, man. I think it's going to be an amazing interview today, and I'm super psyched for it. If you want to drag Dr. Mason in, we're down for that.
Yeah, for sure.
All right.
Hello, Dr. Mason.
Hello, can you hear us, Dr. Mason? I don't know if his audio is working on that end, Damien.
Yeah, no, the audio must have cut out. We were having some audio difficulties with him previously yesterday, but he also might just be away right now. But no, I'm excited to have Dr. Mason on. I feel like he's extremely accomplished and he's extremely insightful and wise, and he has great history at UDC and at other universities.
Absolutely, man. I think that again, it's going to be an amazing experience for all of our viewers and for ourselves, because it's going to be an honor interviewing such a active and knowledgeable man.
Yeah, definitely. And I definitely would say to all our viewers to stick to the end of this episode. Obviously, after the 30, I think Dr. Mason just joined us. Hello, Dr. Mason.
We can't hear you on our end. I think, yeah, we might need to cut out the podcast, Damien, and troubleshoot with this, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so we can start back the podcast.
Yeah, we started it back up right there. Hello, Dr. Mason. Welcome to the Polititeen podcast. If you want to give yourself an introduction here before we begin.
Well, I'm Ronald Mason, president of the University of the District of Columbia, which is the public institution of higher learning in and for the nation's capital.
Amazing, Dr. Mason. Here at Polititeen, our first question is typically what got you into politics or made you politically active? But with you, I'm assuming that it has to be a mix of things, from sitting in the last two rows of a segregated school bus and being the first African-American freshman at Jesuit High School to your longtime friend and first mentor, the late Father Albright McKnight. But what would you say you recall being the moment you knew that you wanted to have a place in politics?
Well, just to correct the record, that was the last two rows in the back of a large Catholic church that we were relegated to. I guess it goes back to early days when, you know, even in grammar school, we would get involved in running for class president, things like that. You know, but everything is politics, because politics is the process of determining how resources are allocated. And so, you know, whether it was elected politics or just, you know, the politics of working with poor people, I've always been engaged one way or the other.
Right. And on the topic of education, as president of UDC, I think a lot of people fail to recognize the important role that colleges like UDC play in guaranteeing equality and comfort for a lot of American students. So, Dr. Mason, being able to speak with leaders of historically black colleges across the nation as a member of the White House Board of Advisors for Historically Black Colleges, and obviously being the president of UDC, I'm a huge HBCU. I wanted to gauge your perspective on why colleges like yours are so important for students.
Well, you know, this is my third HBCU, Historically Black College and University presidency. And before that, I was 18 years as senior vice president and general counsel at Tulane University. So I've seen sort of all aspects of higher education. HBCUs were founded after the Civil War at a time when access to opportunity was not available to Black people, generally speaking. And in a lot of ways, if you look at what's happening now with the civil unrest and the rising realization of the role that white supremacy, the system, is playing in our lives, you can see that there's still a lot of students out here that lack a fair opportunity to succeed. And so HBCUs still play that role. The challenge for HBCUs is that, you know, they're really institutional reflections of the people that they serve. So while they, you know, do a really difficult job and serve a real important role in the higher education industry, they also have little resources to work with because, like the students they serve, they've been denied wealth over the years.
Definitely, Dr. Mason. And, you know, you're talking about the little financials that they're provided with. And at your time at Tulane, it was said that you brought a kind of corporate model to the job of running the business end of the school. And in doing so, you were able to redirect millions of dollars to the focus on academics of the school. But in the wakes of the protests and the riots going on that you mentioned, and the cry of the nation has been right now to defund the police. However, I have thought that the answer isn't typically defunding the police per se, but rather reapproaching how we manage police funds. So my question to you is, what do you believe is the correct approach to the cry to defund the police?
Sure. So, you know, a lot of the protest leaders, at least in the district, and in some cases nationally, are actually students at the University of the District of Columbia. And so I've spent time talking to them. When they say defund the police, they don't mean get rid of police force or police work. Really, what they're talking about is changing the fundamental role that police play in society, especially as it relates to minority and Black communities. Because, you know, the role of the police is to maintain law and order. It's not about justice in America. It really is about law and order. And historically, in a nation that, you know, was founded on slavery, with slavery as the base business model, the biggest perceived threat to law and order has been Black people and Black men. And so you can see why the brutality and the killing really is taking place in front of our very eyes. But, you know, there are models of policing that can be more community oriented, that can be more locally based, that can be more about affirmation and interventions, positive interventions, than about brutality and incarceration. And so when these young people talk about defunding, what they really mean is redirecting the investment in the health of our communities in a way that de-emphasizes criminality, and in some ways is the creation of criminals, but focuses more on healthy interventions that are community-based, which I think makes perfect sense.
Right, and that's a powerful and enlightening statement for all of our viewers and myself. But you mentioned how America was built on a system of upon the backs of African-Americans. And Dr. Mason, myself and Damien are both strong believers in the notion that to truly give birth to a new sense of racial equity, we must not only push forth reform, but we should also make efforts to educate our students about an uncomfortable past and a flawed present. Now, I read your article series in 2016 titled Black America in Black and White, and you talked about how there's a huge divide in how white America sees the African-American minority. So I guess my question to you is, what kind of role do you think that secondary and post-secondary education can play in making people more accepting, and especially in educating people about the history of our country?
Yeah, you know, history is his story, and whoever is the victor or the dominant force, they write the story. But the fact is that what we've been taught and are being taught is in a lot of ways historically inaccurate. I think it's time for America to face the truth of its founding, of who it is, of what it does, because, the irony of America is that the real promise of the nation and the potential of the nation is the fact that we are envisioned as a land of many lands and people of many peoples, where all people are created equal. But our history has been something different, slavery was written into the Constitution, and it was a horrible, evil system where people were bought and sold and mortgaged, and families were separated, and they were treated as property. Sometimes most people don't realize that at one point in time, the value of the slaves was worth more than the value of the cash in all of the banks in America. Yeah. So this was big business, right? But that's not the way we tell our story. And I think any road to recovery starts with the truth, acknowledging what the truth is and accepting the truth is, what the truth is, and then working your way from there. You know, America is still a land of great potential, but unless we start with the reality of who we are, we'll never be able to achieve the ideals of who we want to be.
Yeah, I have to agree with you 1,000%, Dr. Mason. And previously on the podcast here, we've used the illusion that America is a paradise for refugees and a paradise of different people. And we've deemed it a paradox as opposed to a paradise. Because really, historically, this has been a lie. And I think a great example of that has been the use that, thankfully, obviously, our education has been bettered, and I think that we're making appropriate steps, but I don't think that we're making those strides quickly and in such a large manner that we're really going to be able to educate the up-and-coming youth. But my history teacher used the example that America is not a mixing pot, but rather a salad. And what he means by that is that all the pieces, while they might be mixed together, they're separate in true identity. So, you know, you have a bunch of amazing things on your resume, and amazing, amazing achievements. And one of those, you know, obviously being serving three terms on the White House Board of Advisors for Historically Black Colleges and Universities. But your latest project at UDC, the Institute for the Study and Elimination of White Supremacy in America, would you be able to expand on that and kind of explain this project and its implication for our viewers that don't know?
Sure. So, you correctly recognize the role of our university and other HBCUs in America early in the podcast here, right? And the name of our strategic plan is the Equity Imperative, because we embrace our role as one that provides opportunities to students that otherwise would not be able to find those opportunities. But the vision of the Equity Imperative is that all of our students will be able to achieve their highest level of human potential, or whatever that is at that point in time in their lives, but also understanding that potential changes over time. And so we're building the kind of university that can take a student where that student is and enable them to climb the ladder of success academically and in life by the way we construct our programs. But what we ended up realizing was that when you understand how the system of white supremacy works, and just let me describe what that is. You know, it's got three basic roots. One is the power of wealth, which means that 10% of the population controls 77% of the wealth in this country, yeah. And that 10% is 90% white. So that's the first piece. The second piece is the advantage, the daily advantage of being white in America, which more or less means that when it comes time to get a job, you're the first one in line to get a job. And then the third one is black oppression, which is part of our history. But we realize that everything in America is designed to support that system. And as long as that is the fact, you know, talking about things like equity and undoing racism and things like that are really impossible to achieve, because the system that is dominant in America, this system of white supremacy, can't allow that to succeed, because if equity succeeded and undoing racism succeeded, then the system of white supremacy couldn't succeed. And so we came to the point where we realized that even though it is uncomfortable and sometimes fairly dangerous to put white supremacy directly on the table, in order to achieve our goals under the equity imperative, we had to be on work, because otherwise we were just spinning our wheels, and in a generation from now, we'd be having the same conversations. I hope you followed all of them.
You know, I think it's beyond admirable that you're championing the effort to kind of recognize white supremacy for what it is, especially in today's racial climate. But you mentioned something that I found very intriguing, and that's the wealth divide in America between Black Americans and white Americans and our minorities in America. So, Dr. Mason, seeing that the African-American population in our nation is so exposed to poverty, more likely to be uninsured and truly placed at the bottom percentile economically, a lot of people continue to contend that, you know, the problem lies in a so-called quote-unquote Black culture that promotes laziness and such aspects. Well, first of all, I wanted to ask you what you say to individuals, especially those on Capitol Hill, that claim that Black culture is the root cause of these kinds of economic woes. And then I'd like to ask you what you think the path is to creating more economic equity for all races and all humans in America.
Yeah, so my answer to that would be numbers don't lie. The truth is that there are a lot more poor white people in America than there are people of color. Even at the level of zero wealth or less, there are still more white people at that level than there are people of color. The impact of white supremacy is that there are disproportionate numbers of Black and brown people who occupy the lower rungs of income and wealth. But think about it, if 10% of the population controls 77% of the wealth, then that means that 22% of the wealth is left to be divided up among 90% of the population. And more than half of that 90% are white folks. And so, you know, the things that are said about Black people basically being shiftless and lazy, you know, because they have challenges that are poverty-based, are simply that. You know, it's part of the propaganda of white supremacy, you know, that feeds into the narrative that white people are supreme and everybody else who isn't white isn't. So there's that, right? The second part of your question was, what can we do about it economically? You know, I used to work organizing low-income poor people's co-ops in the Deep South, right, and in the Mississippi Delta. And, you know, at one point, with a lot of government subsidy, we had some level of success. But as soon as the government subsidy went away, the level of success went away. Because, you know, you always get just enough to see what's possible. But once you prove what's possible, the support to make it happen generally stops for one reason or another. But that makes sense when you understand that that's the way America's designed. And so whatever interventions you try to engage in at some point, you're going to reach that wall of white supremacy, which basically says that 10% is supposed to succeed and almost everybody else is supposed to survive, some a little better than others and some not at all. When 22% of the population has to share, when 90% of the population has to share 22% of the wealth, everybody's fighting to survive. Some have a little more advantage than others in that process. That's just the way America is set up.
Definitely, Dr. Mason. And I agree with you on the front that some people have different advantages. And, you know, the question is, how can we make those advantages equal? But with that being said, you were mentioning the stereotypes that are kind of created. And it is true that the stereotypes that are created for different races, me being Hispanic, typically the stereotype is either, you know, selling drugs or you know, taking jobs. And unfortunately, the reason that Hispanics, even though, you know, there it's been shown that we commit crime less than, you know, white Americans, the reason that these stereotypes have been created has been because of the opportunities that we have not been provided in white America. But with that being said, obviously you're a big proponent in the belief that race isn't a biological thing. And obviously that's backed by science. It's rather a societal thing. But that leads to the question, and a personal question that I have for you, and that is, does white supremacy exist in other races as well? And what I mean by this is, would I be considered attributing to this white supremacy in America, in your eyes, if I made it out, you know, became someone of stature and someone of wealth, but didn't give back to my community and my brothers and sisters, not only black and brown, but white and beyond?
Well, you know, this is an interesting question. Because I'm probably, in fact, I know I'm in that top 10%, right? And I know a lot of guys who are in that top 10% and are very concerned about, you know, about crossing the lines of that make the people that allowed them to be in that top 10% uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because even me, you know, if I had not had a white mentor, who allowed me to, you know, do what I needed to do to satisfy my conscience in the process of doing my job, I probably wouldn't be sitting where I am doing what I'm doing today. So everybody has to cross that question. But, you know, it's sort of like what Martin Luther King said, you know, even silence can support evil. And you know, the truth is, white supremacy is evil, and it doesn't even work for the people who are at the top of the pyramid, because it's a bad business model. It's a carryover from the days of colonialism, and it is in direct contradiction to what America claims it wants to be. And so the silence support, yes, it does. We all have an obligation to do whatever we can, you know, whenever we can, to make things right. I think, yes, we do. And look, for a young guy like you, let me just the 7 years old, and my retirement is set, and you know, I'm looking forward to you know, being able to say what I need to say without worrying about where my money coming from. Yeah, I'm a little more aggressive these days than I was before. and so I'm practical. But at the same time, I've always understood what the challenge was. And I showed up as best I could, whatever, given the circumstances I was in at the time. I hope that helps.
Definitely does.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talked about silence and how silence is in some forms complicity. And me, myself and Damien, we constantly push forth the idea of the fact that silence is complicity in every single thing that we do. You know, we try to speak out against social issues and social ills, especially things like white supremacy, because in our view, silence is conforming to the status quo and supporting these evils as so. And on the topic of economic inequity and certain topics like that, I wanted to address your most recent article, Forecasting the Weather. You talk about how black and brown communities alike are at the bottom of the economic spectrum, which sometimes proves especially concerning with the global pandemic, you know, at hand. And you talk about how in a perceived attempt to end the bleeding by the Senate, the president politicized even essential stimulus checks. Now, I have a question for you that's coming from a very personal spot. At what point do these issues, such as racial inequity and economic inequity, stop becoming political and instead become moral?
Oh man, it's hard to separate the two. But I'm going to give you a little homework to do after this, okay? When you can, Google an organization called the Council of Conservative Citizens.
Okay.
And that is a direct descendant of the old White Citizens Councils, which was the suit and tie component of the Ku Klux Klan, right? Now, the Klan was the violent, noisy part. There was also a business side that was the elected officials in the business community. And look up their guiding principles and just ask yourself if they look familiar, okay? So having said that, let's talk about this weatherization, which is really the point. The point there is that you know, racism wears people down over time, and you know, there's a reason why people of color, especially poor people of color, are more susceptible to this pandemic, because the stress of being Black and brown has affected their health and their immune system over generations, right?
Yes.
And they also have jobs that put them in these, you know, they're our essential workers, and they're in, you know, the front line of the people of receiving this highly contagious disease, right?
Right.
Now, having said that, okay, and watching, for example, the actions of this administration, when we knew the virus was coming, and this was months before it got here, and they consciously acted like it wasn't going to get here. And look at what's happening now, where the highly disproportionate impact of this virus is on Black and brown people, especially poor people. And, you know, this administration is encouraging people to come to mass gatherings, not wear masks. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine that that they are not aware of what the numbers are going to look like at the end of this, and who it's going to impact disproportionately. And, you know, the fact that these are people that, you know, they're trying to stop from voting by using ID cards, or stop from voting by not allowing mail-in ballots, or stop from voting because they're not going to vote for Trump. You know, is it politics? Is it morality? I don't know. But when you put it all together, you know, it's a hell of a picture that is in the least scary. You know, you know, I think that people should connect the dots and say a whole lot more about it. You know, it cannot be accidental. At least that's my perception of it.
I mean, I have to agree with you. I think there's been too many coincidences at this point. And we've talked about it on the podcast, where at first, you know, some of the stuff that he was saying, he could kind of sweep it under the rug. But and I'm referring to Donald Trump here and his administration. Some of the stuff that they were saying, they could sweep it under the rug and say that it wasn't racist, that it was meant to be this and that it was meant to be that. It's unfortunate that we're still seeing them do it to this day, obviously, with his retweeting of someone yelling white power. It kind of turns the question from it being, is it ignorance, to why is it so much bigotry? Because at first you could pose the question of is it ignorance? But now it's the bigotry that really is the threat here. And thankfully, you know, there's amazing people like you out there that are trying to create this conversation and try to spark it. And here at Politine, we believe that conversation is really the way to move forward in America. And a huge conversation creator in America's youth has been and proves to still be music. And from the poems of those like the late Tupac Shakur in his The Rose That Grew From the Concrete, to the albums of present-day artists like Kendrick Lamar and J. Cole, what impact do you think music, particularly hip-hop, has or lacks having when it comes to the fight against white supremacy?
Oh, I think it's a big impact, and music has always been, you know, part of the process and one of the assets that we use in these moving society forward. It's funny you asked that. I am actually I've actually done some music myself, written and composed and recorded, and put it on YouTube, you know, and it's commentaries on things like the military-industrial complex. I have one called Kaepernick, which talks about, you know, his stand or his kneeling, and what right does Trump have to call Black athletes mothers dogs, you know? And so, yeah, I think it's important. And I don't know all of the artists you mentioned because I haven't kept up with all of them. But I certainly understand the role that it plays, and I've actually played that role myself in a small way.
You know, it's awesome to hear that you're involved in music, and I'd love to hear your music at some point, because we love to hear things like that. We're both big into music, and it would be awesome. But as we're wrapping up today's episode, I want to thank you for coming on. And as we do with all our guests, I want to ask you one final question. If you had one quote, saying, thing or message that you want all Americans and America's youth, especially our viewers, to remember you by, what would it be, Dr. Mason?
We're putting together a website for the Institute for the Study and Elimination of White Supremacy. On the first page, it's an American flag with a quote from James Baldwin. And to paraphrase it, what the quote says is that I love America more than any country in the world. It is exactly for that reason that I deserve the right to criticize it. And I think that's going to be the theme quote for the Institute, and I'll leave you with that quote from me.
Amazing, Dr. Mason. I think that's probably, again, you have been the most insightful guest I think that we've had on the podcast, and I think that it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on, and I want to thank you for coming on, as Varun did. But with that being said, that wraps up our segment with Dr. Mason. Thank you guys all for listening. A quick message from our sponsor, and then me and Varun will be back with commentary. All right, everybody, we are back after our segment with Dr. Mason, and I have to say everything I said, there at the end is absolutely true. He's been, I think, our most insightful guest. His wisdom is unquestioned, and his knowledge on these subjects is just so insightful. What do you have to say on having Dr. Mason on, Brune?
Yeah, so I think that in every point, in every respect, I agree with you. When I heard him speak, I heard somebody who, has a wealth of knowledge in the field of racial justice and has been a proponent of racial causes for his entire life. And I think that I saw the breadth of his wisdom in what he said, because he spoke on things that I've never realized, never thought about, never understood as an American and as a minority. And he speaks for a lot of people in saying that that America was built upon the backs of African Americans, and the system itself has been flawed since day one. It was insightful to hear him say that America was built as a land by the people and for the people, but in reality, it was built upon the backs of Black people, and wealth inequity, economic inequity, and racial inequity has been in the roots of America since day one. And I think it's going to take a lot more than I thought to fix that kind of issue, because it's been in America ever since we begun as a nation.
Yeah, and it's crazy to think, that you can be involved in the race and the culture and the minorities and yet still be so unaware of some of the issues that are really pressing. And it's insane that he knows so much. And another thing that I think is absolutely insane, and something that attests to him knowing so much, and a reason that he does, is because of the fact that that he grew up in a segregated school. He went to a segregated school. He was the first Black freshman, as we mentioned on the podcast, at Jesuit High School. But it's crazy to think, and we've mentioned it on the podcast, that this wasn't that long ago. And I think that's something that this interview is something that attests to that fact. This wasn't that long ago. We just had someone on that grew up in segregated schools. That was the first, African-American, again, freshman at a high school. So it's crazy that we hear this argument of, oh, that was so long ago, why can't we just let it go? But yet we just had someone on that lived through that.
I think that segregation back then was out there. People could see it. And right now the same exact thing is happening, except it's masked. We're having people be in the exact same demeanor, except they're masked by their own faces. And I believe that Dr. Mason has such a strong opinion on these things because he lived through them. I want to say that he's a survivor, because during his period, there were so many threats to African Americans and African American culture that, I wouldn't feel safe in my shoes and in my life. And even now, there's so many threats, and every single African American today is a survivor, because the issues that we're facing as Americans are threatening every single African American in America, and they should be stopped. Because I feel safe in my shoes as a privileged, even as a minority, I'm privileged, and I feel safe in my shoes. We should ensure that every American feels safe in their shoes and don't have to go through the same experiences as Dr. Mason did. Because I think every child in America should live without the fear of being killed, without the fear of being discriminated, and without the fear of being given lesser opportunities and falling into the same hole as their ancestors. And I think we're in danger, in grave danger, of reciprocating that.
And you mentioned the fact that Dr. Mason survived and that African Americans are survivors, and I'm going to have to disagree with you here. And I'm going to have to say that they thrived and that Dr. Mason thrived, because despite the situation that he was put in with the opportunities that he was given, he managed to not only make it out, but managed to make it out and flourish and really be an icon in this movement and being an icon in America. And I think that that's a lot more than we can expect from a lot of African Americans due to the fact of what he deems white supremacy.
Yeah, you know, I think that you spoke in the right direction there. As always, I told you earlier on the podcast, a couple of podcasts ago, about how I watch a motivational video every morning when I wake up. And in the motivational video, it's called Don't Quit. And what it says is the slaves lived and they worked on these plantations so one day they could overcome. And I think it's very powerful, because I think that every person who lives and lived in a period of racial discrimination does so and continues to overcome and struggle. So one day we can live in a world where nobody looks at the color of your skin, but rather at the, you know, the breadth of your heart, who you are as a person, not outside, but inside. I think that, you know, we're making steps to achieve that, but we have to understand that everybody who's fighting for racial justice, including yourself and myself, are fighting today so our children, our grandchildren can live in a better world than we lived in and we live in right now. Because I think that, as Dr. Mason said, a lot of people are becoming blind to how white supremacy really makes a mark in today's world. And his institute is solely to bring a reputation and a awareness to white supremacy. Because a lot of people are just saying racism doesn't exist. Racism does exist. You see it every single day. Yesterday, we saw a white woman coming outside and yelling slurs to protesters and saying, if you touch me, you're going to get arrested. And they're calling him the family the N-word. But they couldn't do anything. They were literally getting provoked by this woman who was threatening them, I guess, saying, touch me, you're gonna get arrested. So I think that racism is well and alive, and we need to recognize that in forms like the White Supremacy Institute of UDC. And in him doing that, I respect him so much, because a lot of people don't give enough attention to this, and that's a direct form of acknowledgement. We have to say the term white supremacy and not be afraid of saying it, because that is our past, and overcoming that is our future.
I agree with you 1,000%, and I think something that might provide a little bit of I guess contradiction to that point is the fact that while Dr. Mason, I think I have to give him tremendous respect for the movement that he's making to make the word white supremacy more said and to paint a picture of the white supremacy that has taken place in America. I can't wait till the day where African Americans don't have to lead this movement, where it can be It can be, you know, someone else and a white man that leads the movement as opposed to an African American.
Yeah, you know, I look at the protests today and I see that white men and white women are leading the crowds. You know, we talked about how the two, you know, white couple that day was holding guns out at protesters, right? And I was looking at the pictures and alongside the black brothers and sisters that were there in protest, there was a lot of white people. And there was a lot of Indian people, and there was a lot of Hispanic people. There was a lot of Asian people. We saw everybody coming together to support our black brothers and sisters, because at the end of the day, you know, we're all humans. And until we can understand that and overcome that, I think we're going to continue to be divided, because a lot of people, they fail to recognize their privilege, whether it's being economically privileged and whether it's being, you know, having white privilege. They fail to recognize that because, you know, they're saying that there's no form of privilege. And once we recognize that, we can say that we're all equal and ensure economic equity, because that's the first step.
Yeah, sorry, I had cut out there. But no, I think that most definitely we have to just look at, and I think it was a great point that he brought on, that this, unfortunately, due to the system beforehand, that black people are disproportionately prohibited advantages that white people are given. But even though that is the case, the equity isn't just a cry from African Americans. It's also a cry from white Americans, because the system hasn't always favored them as well. And I think that there needs to be a change in that sense. I think what I was trying to say with a white person leading the movement, I think that that's going to be the day where, you know, when the white person says, we need an institute for the exploration of racism in America, then that's going to be the day where we really, you know, say, hey, we've taken this stride forward, and we really know, and we really understand the fact that we got here on purpose, and that it wasn't an accident that we face this racism and this disparity in America, and we apologize for that. So now we're going to look at how we can make those steps forward. And I think that Dr. Mason is leading the charge, but I want to see, you know, the baton being passed on in a sense to a white person, and not in the sense that I want them to lead the movement because they're white. I want them to lead the movement because that will show true unity and true unity in moving forward.
Yeah. A lot of white people, and Will brought this on a couple of episodes ago, speaking about the fact that, you know, I should not be held accountable for the woes of my grandfathers and my great-grandfathers in helping slavery go along and helping racism move along. And I think that, in a sense, white people don't have to apologize for their actions and the actions of their grandfathers. But I think that the solution lies in acknowledging that literally 50 years ago, your fathers and your grandfathers were literally discriminating against Black people with no remorse. And you can say all you want about how I'm not racist, I should not have to pay for the actions of people I'm related to, but it says something if you're willing to acknowledge that the people that I'm associating myself with, a lot of them were racist and continue to be inherently racist. And once we acknowledge that racism continues to thrive in America, and that a lot of white Americans continue to be racist, then we can prosper as a country. And maybe it starts with apologizing. I think that we have to stop being so defensive about apologizing and about ourselves and say, you know, I'm going to say it on the podcast today. I apologize for my privilege. I'm a privileged person. And I have failed to recognize how my wealth has affected people of lower socioeconomic statuses in the past decades and ever since I was a kid. I took everything for granted. You know, and when everything fell and I see the issues that my Black brothers and sisters are facing, I learned today that I'm privileged. And I apologize for that. And if I grow up and I gain the wealth that I've been so blessed to have provided, I will give back to my community. And that's a promise I'm willing to make.
Yeah, and I think I have to 1,000% agree with you on the fact that we both have been privileged. And I don't think that it's a question on whether you have to apologize. I think it's acknowledging the fact that you're obligated to acknowledge the past doings and the wrongdoings of your ancestors. I obviously think that a sorry would be a great way to start, but I think that the proper thing, the thing that you are obligated to do is acknowledge the fact that you have done these crimes against humanity. I know that it wasn't maybe you as a person, but your lineage, and you have to question, okay, I'm here because of the act. I may not be attributing to the actions against Black Americans, but I'm here because of the actions that my forefathers took on African Americans. So how can I make sure that I am not, because, you know, we talked about it on the podcast that silence is conforming to status quo. And Dr. Mason said it himself, that if you choose not to speak out against it, then you yourself are, in a sense, an accomplice to it. So you have to wonder, how can I help these people that have been wronged in the past because have led me to the situation that I'm in, thrive and be in the situation that I currently am and have the hopes and dreams that I hope to have.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, upon your point, historically Black colleges and universities, HBCUs, like the University of DC, which Ronald Mason, Dr. Mason is a president of, they play a huge role in guaranteeing socioeconomic equity for a lot of students. I don't care if you're, you know, Black or white or even Hispanic. A lot of people who attend these schools aren't just African American. You know, on one hand, they're people who don't have the money and socioeconomic status to attend regular universities and get a very proficient education and even a better education at these HBCUs, and would charge, I think, $6,000 is the median price of attending HBCUs in America, which is insane for the amount of quality education that they provide. with federal grants. But I wanted to mention that a lot of people attend these schools not only because of their economic status, but also because at bigger name universities, we're seeing systemic racism. And even at big name high schools, like, for example, you know, Natalie brought on the point on Monday's podcast about how, you know, or on Wednesday's podcast, sorry about that, about how, you know, high schools in Georgia have been, you know, for transgender prom queens have been not allowing them to succeed or even become a prom queen or attend prom unless they change their gender status. So I think a lot of high schools and colleges alike are closing in the borders upon people of LGBTQ status and people of racial status. And that's why HBCUs are so important in today's world. They guarantee a safe haven for people who want to escape the racial discrimination that is occurring in America. And I think that their role is going to be fulfilled and diminished once we as Americans come to a standpoint about racism and stop doing these things and thinking it's okay at bigger name colleges. Because as you and I are talking about, Damien, we talked about this off the podcast, how professors are saying the N-word in lectures. And I don't care how you're using it, that alienates students. And that's why your colleges aren't accepting the same rates of students as they were and that's why HBCUs are so important and popular in today's world. Because regular colleges have been conforming to racism and saying it's okay.
Yeah, no, and definitely, and something that I want to and that I love to ask Dr. Mason about if we have the pleasure of having him back on the podcast is affirmative action. And I see, and I've taken this stance on the fact that affirmative action in some sense is offensive. And the fact that we have to have affirmative action to guarantee that I get to go to college is so disgusting. And it's honestly disappointing. Why can't I just go to college because of my academic abilities that I know that I can compete with a white student? I know damn well, and I know you can compete with a white student. And sometimes even I would say that me and you beat most white students that we know. And that's not to brag on them, and that's not to, you know, put them down, but that's to say, why is affirmative action the only means that I am able to succeed, but you can succeed having less knowledge only because of the color of your skin? And I would love to ask him about affirmative action, but the reason that I bring it up is because it has been the cry of white people, and it has been the cry saying, oh, people, how can there be white privilege when black people are so privileged? They get affirmative action, and they're the number one users of our welfare system, and they get free government help, they get food stamps, and blah, blah, blah. The issue is this. You may give an African-American $200, right? You may give an African American $1,000, $10,000, but the issue is they don't know, and this isn't to speak down again on anyone. They haven't been informed due to the way that the system works, how they can use this money to better their future, to better their children's future, to better their grandchildren's future. On the contrary, they might use this money to buy a vehicle that they need. They might use this money and buy something that they don't need, like an iPhone, because it's been the culture that we've been pushing that, you know, oh, an iPhone's a necessity and technology is a necessity. So I ask you this question. If you give a teenager $10,000, do you expect them to put them in bonds and stocks? And do you expect them to put them into bank accounts, into savings account, and watch their money grow? No, because they aren't aware of the fact that you can do that with this money. And you have to acknowledge the same thing. You may have affirmative action, but some African Americans don't even know what affirmative action means, less know how to use it and how to use it to their advantages. So it's not enough to just say, hey, we have this in place, why aren't you using it? Hey, we have food stamps in place. But a lot of African Americans don't know how to take advantages of these systems. And while we may be saying that it's a privilege of being African American in this country, the true privilege lies in having the knowledge.
Yeah, and it's been a thing that I've been a proponent of for so long. Financial literacy is something that Americans should be taught at a very young age. Because I think, and this is a personal opinion of mine, you don't have to necessarily agree with it, to any of our viewers and yourself, Damien, I think that financial literacy is the most important thing that a kid can be taught. Beyond the lines of history, math, science, literature, I think the number one subject that students can be taught is financial literacy. Because I don't care what field you're going into, you're going to have to deal with money. You know, you gain money, you lose money. And if you don't know how to work with money, and to budget and to save your money and to invest your money, it's going to be a hard thing for you. And I think that a lot of people today, especially African-Americans, are in poverty situations because they don't know how to use their money. You know, savings accounts are so important, and they don't have them. In America's most desolate areas, in impoverished areas, these people have no knowledge in relation to how money works. And my grandfather, he worked in India. He's an entrepreneur, but he's failed so many times in India because he had no idea how money works and how to save money. And the first thing he told me when I was young, he used to mail me books and mail me packages of books, and all they were all about stocks and the stock market and how to save your money, how to budget your money. So I learned at a very young age the cost from his stories and his books, the cost of not being financially literate. And I think that having a figure like that in your life for Americans and African Americans is so important, because I learned from his failures, and I think that financial literacy is the single most important thing that high school students and college students and even middle school students like you and I should learn.
Yeah, and I think that this use of the word knowledge that we're kind of saying, and you bring up having a figure, and Dr. Mason says that, you know, the only reason that he succeeded so much is because his first mentor and his first real figure in his life was white. And that's right. Such an interesting point to bring on. And I think it really attests to the fact that you really only do succeed if you're given the knowledge of a white person. And the reason that I'm saying this is because, like you, my parent, or like you had mentioned with your grandfather, my parents were entrepreneurs. And unfortunately, I mentioned this on the podcast with Natalie, it's very difficult to start a business in America. But it's a lot more difficult to start a business when you don't know what the hell you're doing. And unfortunately, a lot of African Americans haven't been provided the opportunity to know what the hell they're doing. And a lot of Hispanics haven't been provided the opportunity to know what the hell they're doing. And that goes from how to run the business, to how to get loans for the business, to how to read a contract. I mean, my parents were played by the contract that the landlord had offered. And unfortunately, this is something that you see oftentimes in the Black community. And even, you know, I mentioned on the podcast a lot of times that J. Cole is quote saying that you can't make it out of the African American community unless you know how to dribble a basketball or how to fiddle with a mic. And even in those circumstances, they get played over because they don't know how to read a contract. So they sign a contract with an agent who's taking 50% of their money, 50% of their income, sorry. And they're being played by the system again because of the fact that they have never been shown, you know, what's a lawyer, how to read a contract. And we, the only people that we can blame is white people for depriving us of this knowledge and taking the knowledge onto themselves. And, you know, again, to mention J. Cole, he says the chains were not physical, they were mental. And I think that those mental chains have yet to be broken. And the true selfishness wasn't using African Americans for their labor, it was depriving them of the knowledge. And I think that that's a pain that lasted generations and generations, not allowing African American slaves to read, not allowing African American slaves to, you know, to speak their language, to speak their truth, their knowledge. I think that that's been the number one way that they've been deprived of everything in life.
You know, I have to ask, is it so much different than it was decades ago? First, we had slaves not being able to read because white people thought they'd be too smart and they'd take over. Now we have African-Americans not gaining financial literacy and not going, their education in African-American hoods and desolate areas is so much lower compared to education in areas like ours. And even in areas like ours, I see very few African-Americans in my school. You know, I don't see that many African Americans. I think Alliance Academy or our school. Sorry, I name blasted that. I want to take
good.
That out.
You're good.
But anyway, our school, as a member of the Forsyth County Board, take that out again. I know that the African American percentage is so low. You know, it's remarkably low. And what I wanted to mention, where I was going with that, is that, you know, half the problem lies in not guaranteeing education for African Americans. And the other half of the problem lies within not guaranteeing education and financial literacy for anybody. Because we're talking about poor whites, literally people who grew up in the privilege of in the peak of society and privilege, losing their money because they have no idea what to do with it. You know, their parents give them this money and they have literally no idea what to do with it. And after a while, I think a lot of these poor whites are being abandoned by their parents and they live in the most socioeconomic and rural areas of America without proper financial knowledge. So I think blame goes both ways. I think that there's a lot of poor whites in America who are suffering the same exact problems. But then again, I wanted to bring in a personal story once again, tagging along what my grandfather said to me. It's what both of my parents said to me when I was very young. And it was when I was studying, and my mom has always been a proponent of me studying. She's always pushed me to succeed and to do more than the average person. And I was like, Mom, why do I have to study so hard? You know, my friends are outside playing. They're playing basketball. Why am I studying so hard inside? And I'll never forget these words that she said to me. She said that, you know, your friends, the color of their skin allows them to go be outside and play basketball. They're white. You know, no matter what they do, they'll gain a job. They'll work under their parents' kind of umbrella. You know, they'll work in any high-level corporate position without the same amount of knowledge. For you, the color of your skin makes you have to work 10 times as hard as these people. And I'll never forget those words because they've pushed me to succeed and to work harder than any person in my school. As you said, we work extremely hard, you and I. You know, we work extremely, extremely hard. And for me, part of that reason is because of the color of my skin and what I've been told ever since I was young.
Yeah, and I have a similar personal story, and I don't know if I've per se ever shared it on the podcast here, but it goes deep in the same aspect. You know, I always wanted to grow my hair out when I was younger, and I always wanted to grow my hair out, and I always asked my mother, you know, why can't I grow my hair out? Why can't I grow my hair out? And she responded to me in a similar way that your mother responded to you. She said, it takes 7 seconds, and I didn't understand what she was saying. And she said, it takes 7 seconds to make a lasting impression on someone. Your first impression is 7 seconds. And if you live in a society where the Hispanic boy with long hair and long curly hair particularly is seen as the drug dealer, as the troublemaker, as this or that. So you haven't been permitted by your society to be allowed to have that hair that you desire. And I always laughed at her, and I would always say, oh, come on, you just don't want me to have long hair. And I never saw the truth in it. And as I grew up and as I am growing up, I'm starting to see the truth in these matters. The fact that, you know, I do have to have my hair cut shorter if I want to go and meet affluent white Americans. And I do have to dress nicer than maybe one of my white peers would have to dress because of the fact that my image has already been drawn before I've arrived into that person's office. You know, yeah. The depiction of me being a thief or me being a drug dealer has already been drawn before I've even made my impression. So I don't have 7 seconds to make the impression. In certain circumstances, I might only have two. And I always hate, you know, pulling the race card and crying and saying, oh, you know, I haven't been allowed the same opportunities, because I've always been a proponent and a strong believer in the fact that if you work hard, that you'll be able to do anything. But unfortunately, what I have failed to see in that mindset is the fact that we have to work harder. We have to work harder in order to really be able to achieve what we want to achieve and what we want to be as Americans. And I guess that goes back to the subject of it being a paradox and not a paradise.
Yeah, and that's so powerful with what we're facing in America. And I think that when I was young, I had this idealistic vision of America. As Dr. Mason mentioned, a lot of people have this idealistic vision of America as a place of acceptance for everybody, when really it's not. You know, there's a lot of racial barriers that hold people like me and you and African Americans across the nation from becoming the people that they were meant to be with their overall propensities of their minds and their hard work. And my goal in life has always been to never have to come to the point where I have to say that I wasn't guaranteed this opportunity because I am Indian. You know, that's always been my goal in life. And I've strived myself to work as hard as I do because I want to make sure that I literally, defeat the stereotype.
Yeah.
You know, I want to make sure that I defeat that stereotype and never have to say that I'm here because I'm Indian or I'm not here because I'm Indian. I want to crash and defeat that racial boundary with all the might in my heart. And I think that what you brought up was an amazing point, even paired with what Natalie said yesterday. You know, students in Forsyth County and a lot of districts in Georgia are kept from expressing themselves and expressing what they feel inside, their hair, what they wear, because it creates stereotypes around race, and that shouldn't be the case. You know, it starts with changing how we approach things like these and understanding that we're all equals, no matter how we look and how we're raised. And you and I, more than anybody, having, you know, we both know, I know you had a very similar upbringing to mine, and you were exposed to these things as a young child. You know, a lot of people are not exposed to these things and these racial truths. So now when they're 20, 30 years old, or even 40 years old, they're seeing the racial tensions in America and finally saying, why wasn't I aware of these things as a child? But, you know, you and I, the part of the reason why we're here is because of how we were brought up. We were exposed to these things at a very young age, as we're seeing right now.
Yeah, and I think that that's why here on Politeen we try to focus on creating a conversation in our youth, because the only way that we'll be able to educate ourselves is if we have that conversation, why we've been such a strong proponent of it here, because we know that those conversations that we had with our parents and people in our community and in our situation are really the reasons that that we are who we are today. And with that being said, I want to invite all of our listeners to go out and have a conversation, to educate yourself and to educate others on not only maybe what you think is right, but on your personal beliefs on what is wrong and their personal beliefs on what is wrong. Because truly, besides educating and beyond educating yourselves about the fact, which we think here on Politeen is absolutely necessary and something that we will thrive and push to do, we have to educate ourselves on the opinions of others to understand their facts. Because although facts are not subject to opinions, in a lot of cases, what a lot of Americans believe is subject to who they were growing up and who they are. So we need to make sure that we understand and adjust everybody's facts to be not that of opinion, but rather that of fact. A fact. Facts need to be facts. And the fact is that in America, we've denied this conversation far too long. And therefore, we invite you to go out and have that conversation. I want to thank, obviously, Dr. Mason for coming on. Although he isn't here, you know, again, he was such an insightful guest. I can say it a million times. And I hope to have him on again on the podcast. We hope that you guys enjoyed having him on. And as always, I want to thank Varun for joining me in this experience.
Absolutely, man. I think that we're growing as people as we continue in the podcast, and we hope all of you are enjoying our podcast as we go. We have a small listener base, but we thank all of you for being so loyal and so supportive of our cause. And with that said, you know, peace out, Politeen family. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at Politeen Show, and stay tuned for this Friday, because we're going to have a guest who is actually part of the LGBTQ community talking about how he feels about coming out and Pride Month being just ended. It's going to be an awesome episode. And next week, hopefully, we will have we're gonna have actually Brenda Lopez Romero, U.S.
I think you're mixing up the weeks, because we're releasing this next Wednesday, aren't we?
Which episode?
Today's episode. Are we releasing this? When will this be out for our listeners?
I believe it's Monday.
Monday. Okay, so then this Friday, if you guys didn't listen to the episode, then go back and listen to the episode that we have with Charlie. As Varun was saying, he was a member of the LGBTQ community, or he is a member of the LGBTQ community. And then what else were your updates, Varun?
Yeah, so next Wednesday we're going to have Representative Brenda Lopez Romero, sorry about that, on the podcast to talk about her overall experiences as a Georgia representative. And hopefully we're going to have Sam Park on the podcast soon. He's also a very big political leader in Johns Creek, Georgia. So that said, thank you all for joining our podcast. And make sure to follow us and connect on Twitter at Politeen Show. Peace out, guys.
Good afternoon.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for watching today's episode of the Politeen Podcast. As always, make sure to follow us on Twitter at Politeen Show, or to, you know, send us an email at politeteenpodcast@gmail.com to connect with our initiative. And lastly, as always, a huge, huge, huge thank you to our research director at Julia Harmon for inspiring the wonderful content that we present day after day, and to our graphic design director and Jada Pilling for the graphics that illuminate our segments. Thank you so much, and have a great rest of your days.